Hello and welcome to another all-new episode of the 3-Bid League podcast. The regular season is over, and we are here to debate the awards that will be coming out presumably sometime Monday afternoon from the conference. And what is becoming a tradition on this show, we're now joined by Matt Ryan. And Matt, this is a tradition not because we want you on here every year to debate the ballots, but because it gets to be late February every year, and we realize we screwed up by not having you on yet. So thank you for once again taking your spot on this pod in March.
Well, thanks for having me. You know, happy to be back talking talking a pretty crazy A-10 year. And yeah, you know, I just assume now that I'll be on to debate the last spot of the third team with you guys and to make, you know, someone who's a fan base that's fighting in the pillow fight angry because we didn't put them in the our fake all A-10 third team. So yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and we need your perspective on this show because you give us the charts and the graphs that no one else is looking at, the master of the A-10 analytics. So I guess either Matt, start us off with where you want to begin this awards ballot debate.
All right, I can get us started off. This was a tough year overall for doing the ballot. I went back and forth a lot, and when we ended up getting our results for polling other A-10 media members and contributors, quite a bit of variance this year, especially once we get down to the third team. But to start off the first team, I went with Daron Holmes of Dayton, the preseason player of the year, and I would say he lived up to it. James Bishop from GW, who just had a career season, way better than the last 2 years with the Colonials. Ace Baldwin of VCU, who I would say is clearly the most important player on the first place team. Yuri Collins, kind of hard to leave off, the nation's assist leader. And then Josh Oduro, who kind of got off to a slow start, but was crucial for the George Mason Patriots in conference play. And he helped them end the season on a 6-game winning streak and has them rolling at the right time of the season.
And I'm pretty in lockstep with you. I have four of the same five, and you know, I made a joke about this being a fake awards, all conference awards team, but you know, we are doing the smart thing and having five players on our first team. So I appreciate that. The only difference between your team that I have is Tumani Kamara in the place of Josh Oduro. And I thought about putting Oduro on my first team. You know, he's definitely had a really good season, another really quality season for the Patriots. But Tumani Kamara has really taken a really big step with Dayton. You know, Daron Holmes is definitely where the Flyers' bread and butter is, but Kamara is just, you know, almost just a slight step down in the impact he's had for Dayton this year. Looking at his numbers last year, I remember the Flyers were actually had a better net rating when he was off the court to when he was on. This year, you know, that's very much quite the opposite. The Dayton averages 107.99 points per 100 possessions when Kamara is on the floor, and when he's off the floor, they average about 8 points less per 100 possessions. When he's on the floor for defense, they average giving up 91.79 points per 100 possessions on defense, and they're about 7 points worse off when he's off the floor. And if we just compare those numbers to Daron, both those numbers are actually better than what happens when Daron is on the court. Slightly better. It's not, you know, a huge difference, but that's why I thought Tumani Kamara should definitely be a first teamer, because, you know, as three University of Dayton alumni, as frustrated as we are with how this season went, they did finish in second, and, you know, Tumani Kamara was a big reason for that. So I think he deserves to be on the first team.
Yeah, and I think, too, with Kamara, and I'll say this also, I made my initial ballot and selections Thursday night before the weekend's games. I had Kamara as a borderline first team pick. I was wrestling between him, Oduro, and Yuri Collins for my last spot. And I think you said it best, his impact for Dayton was so critical. And we saw that when he barely played against St. Louis, just because he was hampered by foul trouble. And Dayton was much worse without him. So that poor performance ended up pushing him down to the second team. Although if we did go with the 6-man team, like the actual conference does, he would have been on my list. It was a very close call, though, and definitely a fair selection to have him for sure.
And only a slight Anthony Grant, what are you doing tangent, but I thought taking him out in the first half there when he had that foul trouble, I think was definitely a mistake and definitely hurt Dayton going into that first half. But don't want to get, you know, derailed on a long Anthony Grant, what are you doing tangent.
That stretch where he was off the court in foul trouble actually changed my ballot in a different way. I'll save those thoughts for later. But the biggest thing I walked away from on the first team is that I thought the coach's first team, which will have the fake six players, it should be very, very obvious this year. It's the exact same six guys that we've just mentioned: Holmes, Collins, Baldwin, Bishop, Oduro, Kamara. I had four very easy choices, three of them the same: Holmes, Collins, Baldwin. And then to me, Josh Oduro was the next guy, leading the conference in rebounds, running away with that title, one of the best scorers in the league. I'm willing to ignore the fact that he's still probably slightly below average on defense. He's a hell of a lot better on that end than he was last year. But I think he's been the best individual player in the final month of the season. He struggled out of the gate. And I should note, I tilt conference play just a lot higher than non-conference. I don't really look at the whole season that much. It's almost more of a tiebreaker for me. And Josh Oduro, from the beginning of February until he got into foul trouble against Dayton, was the best player in the league during that stretch. And that was where George Mason really got things rolling. Him and Ronald Polite got them in position to get that number five seed. And then for my last spot, I went with Tamani Kamara over James Bishop. And yes, Bishop led the league in scoring by a large margin, second in assists. He had an excellent season by all accounts. But he doesn't do that much without the ball in his hands. And Tamani Kamara is a special defender, in addition to being a very good offensive player. In the end, I tossed and turned with this one for a while. I had to go with the two-way excellence of Kamara.
And I just want to, one thing to, you said there, Bishop doesn't do a lot without the ball in his hands. And, you know, certainly the defensive end, you know, comparing him to really anyone else, you know, among these first team candidates, he's, you know, a step down. But one of the craziest stats that I've been tracking all year with Bishop has been just how much his assist rate has increased. You know, as we're speaking, it's up 15.6% compared to what it was last year. He's 108th in the country in assist rate at 28.2%. Last year he was at 12.6%, and he's not taken less shots. His usage rate went up, the percentage of shots that he takes went up for the offense, but he's getting he's getting the rest of his teammates on the GW offense so much more involved that I think, you know, it's really kind of made him more than just, you know, the chucker that we thought he was, you know, the guy that's playing isolation ball under Jamarion Christian and really just kind of calling his own number a lot. And I think that's really been the most impressive thing that I've seen from James Bishop this season.
Yeah, I think it's worth noting, even though they fell off a little bit the last couple weeks, but GW finished with the fourth ranked offense in the A-10, and Bishop was a huge part of that. I think Caputo found the perfect way to use him with his teammates. I do think it is the defense that holds him back. Like, honestly, I think he might have been my second pick for player of the year, but behind Ron Holmes. But just defensively, GW has been kind of a nightmare this year, and Bishop doesn't really help on that end. But yeah, I mean, I think with his crazy usage rate, he's the highest used player in the A-10. And for him to be as efficient as he was, that's just so impressive. And you could honestly, we'll get to this later, but you could make a strong case for him as the most improved player too, I would think.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that there. Now, I'll even say it, I don't think he's even the most improved player on his own team, but certainly a candidate for that. But I guess I'll carry it on to the second team here, keep things rolling. This is another one where, actually, if we were doing six-man teams, I think the second team shakes out really easily. And I felt this about all three of the teams as well. But my second team, led by James Bishop, obviously, Eric Reynolds of St. Joe's, who has just been sensational shooting the ball this year. I really cannot believe how efficient of a shooter he has become in just 1 year. I thought it was going to take him multiple seasons with better teammates around him, but 43.5% from the field this year, 39% from three. That's for the whole season. He was even better than that in the second half. Carried a St. Joe's team that has a defense that's just as bad as GW's, but without the offensive talent that Bishop has around him, to almost escaping the pillow fight. They got stuck in there on a tiebreaker. I thought he ran away with that spot. Khalid Moore, who is the best player on Fordham, ignore the scoring numbers. This guy does absolutely everything for them. And I want to talk a little bit more specifically about his key impacts later, but he's the all-around key guy for the three seed. Tyler Burton of Richmond, who, yes, his three-point shooting numbers sucked in conference play, and Richmond ended up in 12th place, but he really carried that team. They don't have offense without him. He's the one guy who can put the ball in the bucket for them, continues to be an elite two-point shooter. And then Day-Day Grant for Duquesne. And I know Matt will want to talk about this one. His shooting numbers tailed off a little bit late in the season. He was not the same guy in the second half as he was when he was an elite offensive weapon in the first half. But he's Duquesne's one solution on the offensive end. He's the guy who makes the tough shots for them when a lot of these other guys are kind of just playing in the flow. He became a really good defender in the second half as well. He was critical to their defense being so great. The fact that he was no longer the weak link he was in the non-conference.
I had a couple differences from my second team. Since I didn't have Aduro on my first team, I had him, in my second team. I had Day-Day Grant, but I had three different players. And oh no, sorry, I also had Reynolds in my second team as well. And I want to first, talk about, like you said, how impressive Reynolds has been, in his second year under Billy Ling. Like you said, he's one of the most efficient scorers in the conference, and really, having to carry a large load of it, by himself. He's top 400 in the country in effective field goal, and really the one who's kind of making St. Louis go, St. Joseph's go. The one person I wanted to bring up was, you had mentioned that you thought that Khalid Moore was the best player in Fordham. And I know I'm supposed to be the analytics guy, but I actually had Darius Quisenberry in my second team for Fordham. And it's kind of more for the intangibles. He certainly, has some impressive numbers. He's got a 19.6% assist rate. He really limits the turnovers, only a 12.1 turnover rate for running that Fordham offense. He gets to the line a lot. He's got a 43.6% free throw rate. So he's getting trips to the stripe. He's making 84% of them. And he's really just kind of brings the heart and the hustle along with those numbers to the Fordham team that, has reached heights that we haven't seen, in decades. So I thought, not to skip ahead, he was my glue guy of the year as well. But I think, leading that Fordham offense and bringing them to a top four seed for the first time in forever, it felt like he was a second teamer for me.
All right. I had a couple differences. Overall, pretty similar, although one difference that Tyler already alluded to. So Tumani Kamara, my first guy in the second team, already talked about. And then Eric Reynolds, who really, he's kind of just James Bishop without the assists. And that was the difference for me to not put him on the first team, but great season for St. Joe's. Tyler Burton, who, one thing I wanted to highlight, even though Richmond's defense really dropped off at the end of the year, but he was top 10 in the A-10 in steals this year, which I did not expect. And for a while, the Spiders were one of the better defensive teams in the league. So overall, just a great all-around player. I was in agreement with Tyler that Khalid Moore has been Fordham's best player, especially in conference play. And really what it came down to for me is just that even though Fordham has had some greater moments than last year offensively, it's still not a good shooting team. We saw them go, I think, 15, 16 minutes without a field goal against George Mason last week. So they've struggled at times. And I feel like Moore brings more on the defensive end for the Rams. And overall, just felt like he was a little bit more consistent of a player, where Quisenberry's efficiency numbers did drop off quite a bit once he started playing stronger competition in the conference season. But still a great season, and I'll have him coming up later. My last pick here, which I actually struggled quite a bit going back and forth for my last second team selection, I had Sam Enenga from Davidson, and just felt like overall he was the Wildcats' best player, where Foster Lawyer hit a cold streak during conference play, but Enenga was still, I believe, top 10 in conference play in scoring and rebounding. Just a consistent performer, and he ended up helping Davidson get out of the pillow fight down the stretch, where the Wildcats had to play probably the toughest schedule in the A-10 this year. And as we talked about last week with Dr. John, they went 0-6 against the top three, or sorry, I guess top two, and then St. Louis. So a tough draw for them, and they still managed to finish in the 8-9 game.
Yeah, I Menega in my second team, I forgot about him. And just looking at his numbers, it's really clear. He does everything. You know, he's, you know, really efficient scorer, rebounder. He has a 10% assist rate. So, you know, he's really kind of doing a little bit of everything for the Wildcats this season. You know, it wasn't, you know, a season as good as they've had in the past few years, but, you know, he's really been kind of the, with Foster Lawyer kind of being inconsistent up and down all year, he's been the one thing that Davidson could rely on all season. So yeah, I agree. He was on my second team as well.
And also, too, with this being the by far the worst three-point shooting team we've seen from Davidson since they joined the A-10, Menenga shot 38% in conference play. So he built on what he started at the end of last season and continued to be a good three-point shooter. So maybe that's something, I mean, they're going to need to see even more of next year with Lawyer graduating.
Yeah, and I even think he could probably take more. You know, only 22.5% of his shots were from three. And if he takes more, you know, that 38% is going to go down. That's just kind of how it works with efficiency. But, I mean, it's still going to be above efficient. And it's, you know, it's going to make probably the biggest defender on the court, you know, on the opposition, have to track him, you know, anywhere on the court. So, you know, you would like to see maybe more threes next season, but yeah, it's something that he clearly can do.
Yeah, Menenga was actually, maybe, well, this will come as a little bit of a surprise to you guys. He was my 15th and final guy to make the all-conference team. And a little piece of it was the eye test element. I felt like he disappeared too many times in big games and didn't watch every moment that Davidson played, but there were just too many instances. I think back especially about that Friday night St. Louis game, the one where everyone on the Billikens was in foul trouble. And Davidson really had a chance to kind of just put the clamps on early on. And I felt like Menenga just wasn't making a big enough impact in some of these huge games. Now, what he did do was dominate bottom teams. He was awesome in a lot of those big wins that they had against the Pillow Fighters that elevated them to the middle of the conference. But that's why I ended up putting him on in total. But there's actually a few guys that I still had above him.
And that kind of is how I felt kind of about him, but also about Tyler Burton too. You know, Tyler Burton probably has, besides Daron Holmes and maybe Tamani Kamara as, you know, a D-League player, he probably has the best pro prospects of any A-10 player that's going to be draft eligible.
I would say more than Kamara.
What's that?
I would say he has better prospects than Kamara.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I just mean, you know, those three are probably the best, have the best pro prospects, you know, playing in the NBA someday. And I just feel like, you know, because of just how tough of a season it was for Richmond, same thing for Davidson, you know, kind of not getting that big win against top competition. It was just kind of a lot of beating up on lower competition. You know, his numbers, Burton's numbers are great, you know, that he's an efficient scorer at the rim. He's an efficient scorer, you know, well, this 3-point range, he kind of had a dip this season, but he's, you know, athletic. He plays defense, but he just, you know, isn't the kind of guy that's going to be able to put Richmond over the top. And with a, you know, the lack of help that he had this season, you know, the after losing, you know, those quality guys that Richmond had last year. So, you know, he's definitely a third teamer, even, you know, I wouldn't oppose to a second teamer, but him and Menenga are kind of in the same boat where their team's lack of success probably hurts them in where they fall in these rankings.
All right, Matt, why don't you, do you want to lead us off with your third team? And I'm hoping here, well, I at least know for my picks, comparing them to everyone else who sent us ballots, I know I'm going to have some differences, but I'm interested to hear what we all have on this final team.
Sure. So, one of these guys, this isn't the case, but kind of talking along with Burton, these are kind of guys who had were on kind of meh teams as well. Burton, as I mentioned, he was, you know, on my third team. The guy who that doesn't apply to, whose team won the conference, Jalen Deloach, I put him as a third teamer. RJ Lewis, Ishmael Leggett, and Daryl Banks, who kind of, you know, were on the bottom half of the conference most of the season. And they're just kind of guys, especially Leggett. You know, Leggett was very impressive in a very, very bad Rhode Island team. He was someone who could score efficiently. He could get to the free throw line, and he could convert when he was there. And, you know, Rhode Island was one of the worst offenses in the country. Looking at KenPom, they were ranked 303rd, you know, coming into tonight. So he's had to carry the load, and he's done it. He's gotten his stats, and he's, you know, for that, I think, you know, you had to give him some credit.
The RJ Lewis one, when I saw your, cause I saw your ballot ahead of time, obviously had to tally this all together. I believe you were the only person to vote for him third team. And I have an RJ Lewis rant fired up for when we talk about rookie of the year, but that was maybe the most interesting vote I saw on any of these ballots.
And the reason, you know, a very bad team and a very disappointing team, but his emergence, you know, he basically was, you know, especially with Cross injured, with Fernandes injured, and, you know, Frank Martin not really knowing what his rotation should be. Lewis kind of emerged and kind of took the reins and, you know, was able to be able to provide a little on offense, get to the free throw line, but then really, you know, help out on defense, you know, averaging 2.9% steal rate. And so that's really kind of the bright spot of the UMass season. And for that, I snuck him on to the 13.
Yeah, I think that's a fair pick. And it was kind of tough with him just because he didn't get as many minutes as a lot of the other all-conference team guys. But you look at what he did in conference play when Fernandes and Cross went down, Lewis got way more efficient too. So definitely think that's a fair pick.
And he had the highest usage rate of any mm-hmm. UMass player, you know, in the season. So I think, you know, Martin learned kind of as the season emerged that especially with, you know, lack of better options that he had to rely on Lewis. And it's really good for just outside of the kind of the all conference team, you know, perspective, getting a young guy like that, you know, minutes like that early on is really good for his development. You know, he's played crunch time minutes. He's, you know, put the team on his shoulders with, you know, having to so early in his career. And that's just going to benefit him, you know, going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So for my third team, I had Darius Quisenberry, talked about him a bit earlier, still a crucial player for a really good team, but just wasn't quite as high on him. Jalen Deloach, who I'm glad you brought up. And overall, I think he honestly surprised me. Like, I feel like throughout the season, I've got a pretty good grasp of the stats in the Atlantic 10 and who's performing well, but it caught me off guard. He's top six in the conference in offensive and defensive rebounding rate, so aside from maybe Tumani Kamara and Josh Oduro, he's right up there. Top 25 in both blocks and steals rate. So an all-around outstanding defender. And then he also backed that up by being 13th in effective field goal percentage. So really, the only thing he does poorly, he's a bad free throw shooter, but he's efficient offensively and he's outstanding defensively. So looking through, I knew I needed a second VCU player, and kind of just emerged that he was the second most deserving behind Ace.
Yeah, he's one of those. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, yeah, now keeping on with him.
Well, I was going to say, you know, he's just another one of those VCU guys that's going to put up, you know, that's going to get lots of blocks and steals. They talk about a lot that a good way to measure if a player is athletic enough to play in the NBA mm-hmm. is if he's got at least a 2% steal rate and at least a 2% block rate. And as you mentioned, you know, he's a 5.9% block rate and 2.5% steal rate. And as you said, he's a really efficient scorer in the paint. He scored 70% of his shots at the rim. And that's really kind of all he does. You know, he doesn't really have much offense, you know, besides getting in the paint. You know, maybe if you'd like to kind of see him as he develops, you know, maybe get a little bit more of a mid-range. I don't even think he attempted a three this season. So that might be something to work on, but like he's just kind of the prototypical, you know, steals and blocks VCU guy that's also going to be able to score pretty at will at the rim.
And yeah, I think
he did
too,
not take a three as a
he didn't take a three.
Probably
season.
A good thing.
Yeah,
but I think with him, and like it sometimes happens with other VCU players, it feels weird to vote for a guy who averaged 10 points a game, but you have to look at VCU, like their scoring attack minus the year they had Bones, it's always really spread out, and
yeah,
their depth is their value. Like they never really need big scores that to have success as a team. So I think you just have to overlook that. But my last three selections, so I had Khalil Brantley from LaSalle, and this is kind of a biased pick, but he is the triple nickel god in the A-10, almost averaged one for the season, and felt like he kept LaSalle in a lot of games this year, even though they hit a bit of a losing streak at the end. And then my last two, so out of our 18 contributors who emailed us ballots, I think I was a lone wolf on the two of these, but I had Ronald Polite from George Mason. And you look back at the Patriots season when they had a disaster of an MTE. Guess who got hurt against Boston College in the first game of that trip? And then the Patriots really struggled the rest of that weekend. And he was also out for the VCU game in conference, which might have been Mason's worst game later in the season. So I think Polite was just outstanding as a point guard. And simply if George Mason got last year's Ronald Polite, they would have been a pillow fight team. They needed him to step up as a point guard. And then my last one, Trey Clark from Duquesne, which I know Tyler disagrees a little bit, but I think for the Dukes, he was their most important player in conference play. And to me, what made Duquesne a contender late in the season was their improved defense. And Clark led the A-10 in steals. He was not an offensive liability as he was at times at VCU. He shot the ball pretty well, tailed off a little bit at the end, but still good enough that he didn't hurt the Dukes. And I just think without Clark's contributions, I could have, it still would have been better than the Duquesne team that went 1-16 in the league or 1-17, but it wouldn't have been a whole lot better than last year's defense, in my opinion. He made such a huge difference for Duquesne.
So, because as anyone who listens to this deeply knows, I've been hoping all season that Trey Clark would be an all-conference player. And I think he was absolutely headed there in early February. His shooting has really tailed off in the last month of the season. And with the Dukes dropping to six, he kind of fell off the radar. He would have been one of my honorable mentions. He was one of basically 21 players that I felt like were good enough to at least be in the conversation for all conference. As for Ronald Polite, I was so happy that you put him on there. You're the only person to include him. He deserved to be listed on the vote count. He was my 16th guy. He was my last cut, actually directly for Sam Menenga. It came a little too late in the season for him to start playing like a star. He did it occasionally in November, December. And then there was about a month to start A-10 play where he just was just a decent point guard. The last month, he's been incredible. I expect him to be on the preseason team next year and to continue to grow and make it. And actually, I'll say this right now. He's not going to, because of all the volume scoring guards who will probably get rewarded. Ronald Polite should be on the real team that has 18 players. But
I hope so. He finished the season during George Mason's six-game winning streak. He had double figures in all six. So, the Patriots were just a better team when he was healthy and playing and making a big impact.
Yeah, and he was one of the last guys I left out on OLI outside looking in. And I think how he went, that's kind of how George Mason went. George Mason was so up and down in conference play, win a game, lose a game, lose two games, and then their latest winning streak. Looking at kind of the game log, he didn't play against VCU. He scored four in the loss to Duquesne. He scored, he scored 12 against St. Joe's, but I just think he kind of, like George Mason, he wasn't consistent till the end of the season, like you mentioned. And I think that's just kind of what made me keep him off my list. I want to go back to Clark real quick And because the reason he's not on my all, he's not on any of my teams, but he is, and not to jump the gun, but he is on my all defense team. And the reason I put him on the steals, like you mentioned, but Duquesne improves by 4 points by 100 possessions when he is on the court compared to when he is off. And they are an above average defense when he is on the court compared to a below average defense when looking at net rating when he is off. So for that reason, you know, I didn't think he was good enough to be on any of the all conference teams, but he definitely was good enough because of the steals and because of just the impact on, you know, opponents scoring when he is on the court compared to when he's off. That's why I put him on my all defense team.
Yeah, and so finishing up my third team, I had, as I already mentioned, Mnanga, Jalen Deloach. Couldn't agree more. He maybe didn't quite put up the numbers to be an all-conference player, but in the last few weeks of the season, he established himself as VCU's clear number two guy for a team that ran away with the conference title, and they deserve that representation. He's the only rim protector on that team. They're so thin in the front court. We saw it in the non-conference and early in conference play when he was taking stupid fouls all the time, how badly it hurt the Rams for him to not be out there. He's really cleaned that up here to close out the season, an absolute beast on the boards. And about a month ago, I actually was preparing to give this spot to Brandon Johns Jr., but the difference defensively is just too big. Deloach being a top-end defender, a guy that would have been on my second team all defense if such a thing existed. Carrying on, the easiest pick for this team, Brendan Adams, GW, the best three-point shooter on a team that relies on speed and offense but doesn't shoot the three very well. The worthy sidekick to James Bishop all year long. He was absolutely sensational this season. The other one that became easy, and this is why I don't like filling mine out till after the games are done, but Darius Quisenberry, whose shooting numbers in conference play are truly atrocious. Like, he shot the ball awful in conference play, and I don't think people realize that. 39% from the field. He's under 30% from three. But Fordham makes their bones on defense. He's not their best defender, but he's good on that end. And with all of these hard-nosed, beat you up on that end, crash the boards, guys around him, someone has to score for Fordham. And without Darius Quisenberry, there is absolutely no way that they're in third right now. They're somewhere around the middle of the conference. And you can say that about a few teams. Like, you can make that same case for how bad would Rhode Island be if they didn't have Ish Leggett. And Matt, I think you said this already, but there's a difference when your scoring's helping you avoid the basement versus being a legitimate contender. And then my second to last spot, I ended up giving to Gibson Jimerson. And this is another guy who, like Josh Aduro, I'm rewarding his final month of the season, where I actually thought in a lot of these games down the stretch, he was the Billikens' best player. Even better than Yuri Collins in some of these nights. He's come alive as a three-level scorer again. He still doesn't contribute that much, although he's a good rebounder at this point. And he's the guy spacing the floor for one of the top two offenses in this league, the second best three-point shooting team in the conference. And it was a tough decision. This is not the type of player that I tend to put on here, but in the end, I felt like he played his way on in February.
So I got two quick stats for two players you mentioned there. First about Jimerson. I mean, I remember his first few years where he was almost exclusively a 3-point shooter. This year he took 28.9% of his shots at the rim. I mean, compare that to his freshman year where he took it was
1%.
yeah, eight well pretty close, 8.2% of his shots at the rim. So I mean, he's an above average scorer, like right above, just about above average, but an above average scorer at the rim. So I think he's worthy of another outside looking in, but definitely don't hate that pick. And then one more defense of Darius Quisenberry. You know, we're talking about his shooting numbers, but again, it's the impact that he has, and that's kind of shown in the on off numbers. Again, you know, the Fordham's offensive rating when he is on the court is 102.57. When he's off the court, it's 94.81. So, you know, he might not be, you know, scoring all those points, but he's definitely having an impact on Fordham's offense, even though it's not great. You know, they're definitely a defense first team, but it would be abysmal without him.
Yeah, and before we wrap up the all conference, I guess most of the guys that I also deeply considered were mentioned here: Clark, Leggett, Brantley. Who I feel like Brantley, Leggett, and Daryl Banks are all in the same boat. They're all guys who make their bones as a scorer first and foremost, but just like Quisenberry, have not shot the ball particularly well. They're not one-dimensional players. They all do something else very well. Brantley is a great passer. Leggett's an incredible rebounder for a guard. Banks is St. Bonaventure's best perimeter defender. But the inefficiencies for teams under 500, I couldn't pull the trigger on those guys. Trey Clark just missed out. Like I mentioned, Polite was my first guy left off. Right with him was Foster Lawyer, who almost got the Menenga spot. Just once again, he just didn't play that well in December, January. And one of the things that kind of threw me off with him, didn't even lead Davidson in scoring or assists in conference play. Those titles went to Menenga and Grant Huffman respectively. But I do want to ask you guys, when the teams jump from 15 to 18, the conference teams, who are the other three that you feel like deserve to be on there? And for me, it's Lawyer, it's Polite, and a guy that has not been mentioned and I do not think will be mentioned. I would give my final spot by a tiny margin over Banks and Trey Clark to Lynn Greer III, who has played out of his mind for 3 weeks in all phases of the game.
So Ronald Polite would definitely be one of mine. I think in a dreadful year, a dreadful transition to the Atlantic 10, I think the best thing that happened to Loyola Chicago is the emergence of Philip Alston. And it's just, you know, there's not really a lot good to write home about, but they found, you know, a guy in D2 that they can build around, and that can be, if he's surrounded with some pieces, that some actual D1 pieces, then I think he can really shine. So he's definitely a name that I think, you know, should be on. I don't know if he will be, just because Loyola's just been so terrible, but he's been kind of the one shining light in Chicago this year.
So I think for me, I didn't have Day-Day Grant. I'm sure he's going to make it. And he was my first guy off. Ish Leggett, I was on the fence. I had him on my third team for a while and backed him out at the end. Really good stats. Like, he actually surprised me as a great rebounder this year. And the fact that he found a way to score as efficiently as he did on a terrible Rhode Island team.
You get a lot of rebounds when there's a lot of misses. So
That's true, too. That doesn't hurt. But he had a great individual season for his sake. Like, he's gotten better and better each year too. I hope we see him on a competitive A-10 team before he graduates. It feels weird to me. Like, VCU went 15-3, and we didn't really consider having a third player on, which you would expect in a normal year that would happen. So I feel like Brandon Johns just never spectacular during the season, but he was pretty consistently a factor for VCU, especially early in the season when they didn't have Ace Baldwin available all the time. They were leaning on him quite a bit. And then the last thing too for me, it seemed kind of weird. I didn't really consider anyone from St. Bonaventure, even though they had a decent season, finished very poorly, and maybe that was why. I just felt like Daryl Banks was too inconsistent, too inefficient as a volume scorer. I actually thought about Chad Venning just from an eye test perspective. Just his size is so imposing and impacts the way teams have to defend St. Bonaventure. So, I just don't think he had quite the volume to warrant an all-conference selection, but I think he's someone to watch for next year.
And just to add on to what you mentioned about Johns, he was definitely someone who impressed me. The comeback that VCU made against Dayton, you know, everyone remembers mm-hmm. David Shriver's, you know, insane shooting performance. But I thought Johns was really, really effective, both scoring against Deron Holmes and defending Deron Holmes in that game. And I thought he was in a game that, you know, besides David Shriver, no one else was really, you know, scoring very well for VCU in when they needed it. I thought he was really, you know, a key to them, you know, coming back in that game. And looking at the numbers, he actually had the second most shots on VCU's team besides Ace. You know, it's all pretty close. but he's an efficient scorer in the paint, and he's just someone who's going to play tough defense. So I like that pick. You know, I think he might be, I don't think he'll get on the team because, like you said, everyone's just so even on VCU that it's hard to kind of differentiate between them. But he's definitely someone who's impressed me this season.
Yeah, John's basically kept VCU alive in the first half of that Dayton game. And we can talk about that later when we get to game of the year. But I guess we'll keep it moving on to the old defensive team here. I'll just fire mine out real quick. I don't feel like there's anything super controversial here. Tamani Kamara, the most versatile Swiss Army knife defender in the league. Deron Holmes, the best rim protector. Ace Baldwin, the best one-on-one perimeter defender. Trey Clark, the best ball swiper. And then Kyle Rose, coming off the bench for Fordham, he gets my last spot over a host of guys. The key to Fordham's second best in the A-10 defense. Everyone in that locker room rallies around him on that side of the ball. And for me, I really didn't consider anyone outside of players on those four teams because those have been far and away the four best defenses in the A-10 these last 2 months. And we don't have a situation like the last few years where we had a mediocre Richmond defense led by a great defensive player in Jacob Gilliard. Just none of the mid to lower defenses have that Gilliard guy this year.
Yeah, I'm pretty much in agreement. My one difference, I had Jalen DeLoach over Deron Holmes. And really what surprised me, Holmes's block rate went down quite a bit from a tremendous freshman season, although he would have been my sixth man. I don't have too much else to add, although I just want to highlight Kyle Rose, who I think his career at Fordham has been so interesting. He's stuck with the Rams through multiple coaching changes. And if you go back to his freshman and sophomore years, it's hard to find a worse offensive player. He did absolutely nothing with the ball. He was a terrible three-point shooter. But even from the very beginning, he was getting minutes under Jeff Neubauer because he could defend. And he always rated out really well as a perimeter defender. Now it's finally come together where he's a pretty decent offensive player too, but on a team full of great guards who can defend, like I think Quisenberry, who we've talked about, Antrell Charlton's really good for Fordham. In the paint, you could have Simbilga, who led the conference in blocks. Like Fordham has a lot of options, but I think you hit on it. To me, Kyle Rose is the heart and soul of a Fordham defense that has now been really good the last 3 years.
Yeah, and just on the all-defensive team overall, you know, leading up to the last few days of the season, I saw a lot of fans for a lot of different teams saying, oh, my guy needs to be on the all-defense team this season. And I just thought, there's four guys that are definitely making it, you know, so where are you going to fit your guy in there? And the only difference that I had was Simbila, only because he was top 10 in the country in block percentage, in block rate. You know, I definitely don't hate the Rose pick, but I think, you know, if you're one of the 10 best shot blockers in the country, I think you definitely deserve a place in the all defense team. But that was the only difference that I had from you guys.
Yeah, I think with Fordham too, like it's interesting because both Simbilga and Rostik Nowitzki are like two of the leaders in the 8-10 in blocks, but they're also just foul machines, which I think it helps that Fordham has two great bigs that they can alternate between. But that was one thing holding me back, which maybe it's impressive that Simbilga had so many blocks in a short amount of time, but he just had a harder time staying on the court compared to Holmes and DeLoach for me.
And on that note, you know, he somehow has 5.7 fouls called per 40 minutes, which I'm not really sure how that works since, you know, you only have five a game. But no, I mean, it's the math of playing for doing it over 40 minutes, but it definitely shows shows the foul problem he has. But you know, it's you're gonna foul when you're blocking that many shots.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and other acceptable answers for this: the other VCU perimeter starters, Jaden Nunn and Nick Kern, the critical pieces to that pressure defense, along with Ace Baldwin. You really couldn't go wrong with any of VCU's four best defensive starters. Apologies to Brandon Johns Jr. We know he's the weak link in that starting lineup defensively.
Yeah, quietly too, Jaden Nunn, like, I think Ace has a strong case to be the defensive player of the year for the actual awards, and he's who you think of for VCU's guards, but Nunn led the conference in defensive box plus minus, and Matt, as you mentioned earlier, as like NBA prospects, guys who can block and steal a lot on defense. He was close to that 2.5% threshold, 3% steal rate in conference, and just under it 2.2% for his block rate.
Well, it's actually just two flat. So
he made it.
Yeah.
There we go. All right. I think, should we go into all rookie team next? This was a tough one for me. Between, I really felt like there were two rookie of the year candidates. And so I had them both, RJ Lewis and Maximus Edwards. Just the two most critical freshmen in the conference that really for the entire season played important roles on their respective teams. I went with Jan Farrell, who I don't think anyone really expected it, but he became one of the best three-point shooters in conference play as an ancillary piece for the Bonnies. Kind of the same story for Will Richardson, who emerged in conference play for Fordham and ended up shooting 43% from deep in league play. And then for the last spot, this was a real challenge, but I already know this is going to be one of my top breakout picks of next season. Rashear Fleming for St. Joe's, who I think helped keep the Hawks defense alive at times, top 10 in block rate in the league, really good rebounder. And he's a guy too, I forget which broadcast this was, but talked about how the St. Joe's coaching staff went to scout another player and they ended up finding Fleming, who wasn't getting any major college looks. Like, he's really just a project. And I think he's either like late 17 or early 18. Like, he's a young freshman still learning how to play the game of basketball at a D1 level. I think he could explode next year, but defensively, he's already pretty solid for the Hawks.
Yeah, I thought Edwards and Lewis were the obvious picks. I thought Farrell definitely deserved a spot on the team. I put Jason Nelson. You know, it seemed like at a time he was going to run away with the rookie of the year award, but he kind of fell back to earth. You know, as conference play carried on, but then the last pick. And I'm not sure if I'm just throwing a bone to Loyola because of just the tough year that they had. But I went with Ben Schweiger. He's a 6'7", but he's really, a very good shooter, jump shooter. You know, he's decent at scoring at the rim, you know, an average at that, but he shoots 42% from the mid range, which is above average. And he shot 34% from three. So if he can kind of improve, get a little stronger at the rim, I think he's going to be another solid piece that Loyola can really try to rebound from the tough year that they had this year.
Yeah, I don't even see any point in discussing Louise Edwards or Farrell. Those are guys we should save our words for the rookie of the year discussion for them. They've been locked into this team for almost 2 months now. The other easy one for me was Will Richardson, who just really played his way on in the final 6 weeks of the season. The biggest stat for him, 42.5% shooting from three in conference play for a Fordham team that shot 29% collectively over that time. He's the one floor spacer that the Rams have. His role is so instrumental and critical to what they're doing. And then the last spot was pretty tough. There was no clear fifth guy. I wanted to talk myself into a homer move of picking Kareem Rozier and talking about how important leadership is on this episode, but couldn't quite do it. I ended up going with Ben Schweiger as well. Really the lone non-Alston bright spot for Loyola this season. For most of January, February, I really felt like there were only three guys that could hurt the opponent offensively. Alston spacing the floor and attacking the rim, Braden Norris moving the ball around, and Schweiger in the corner. And that was about all the Ramblers had.
And even, I mean, Norris was kind of, exhibit A of the turnover problems that they have. That was really surprising. So, yeah, Schweiger really kind of, he had his own turnover problems too, but he was really kind of one of the only places that they could really look for a bucket and feel relatively confident that they could get one.
So I feel like we're at a good spot. Should we just carry this on to the rookie of the year award discussion? Because Tyler, I think you hit on it. There were three guys pretty clearly locked into this team from the beginning of conference play. I think I thought it would be Maximus Edwards throughout the season, just watching GW play, watching them have a lot of entertaining games. But Matt, you put RJ Lewis on your third team, and
And did not and realized that I didn't put him as my rookie of the year. And that's just what happens when you have two kids and you know they're not sleeping as well. So I would definitely change it to RJ Lewis. I had Jan Farrell, and I think it was because of the 3-point shooting and the impact that he had on St. Bonaventure's offense. But yeah, if the conference wants to give me a vote, I'll definitely pay more attention, make sure that the guy that's on my all conference third team is definitely my rookie of the year.
Well, they're just spreading out the votes. That's okay. But I think for me, what it came down to in the end, for both Edwards and Farrell, like really good freshman seasons, they're going to be important players as long as they're in the A10. But they were also just role players where RJ Lewis took over for UMass. And the fact that he led in usage by such a wide margin over those guys and got more efficient in conference play. Like, I think early watching him, he was so inconsistent. His shot selection wasn't great. And that's still something I want to look at more in the offseason, where he took an awful lot of mid-range shots for someone who's not very good at them. I think he got smarter about that later in the year. And just the fact that he was, for a good chunk of conference play, UMass's best player, I had to give him the nod.
And just talking about his shooting, he almost took the same amount of shots at the rim as he did from the mid-range, just slightly by less than a percentage point more at the rim this season. But along with the numbers, I think the thing that kind of led everyone late to the party on him is I think UMass Twitter was mostly talking about Kapari all season. So we were wondering about, why isn't Kapari getting in? And maybe if you're not watching every UMass game in the non-con and the first few games of conference play, you're thinking about Kapari. But I mean, RJ Lewis was just really impressive. Really took leadership on a team that desperately needed it. And I think he's going to continue to be an all conference player, as his career continues at UMass.
So going into the week, I thought that Jan Farrell was going to end up getting my vote until I really dug into the numbers and ended up going with RJ Lewis as well. And he would have been the second or third topic on the show this week if this hadn't been the end of the regular season. If this was just mid-February right now, I would have left myself a good 3 to 5 minutes to just go on an RJ Lewis tangent because I finally got to see him in person this week. And both of the UMass freshmen are something in person. With Kapare, I would just use the word mesmerizing. Just how he moves around the floor. He's such an incredible athlete in a way that you can't even tell on TV. And I get why the UMass fans are obsessed with him now. Because if he can end up with just like B plus level skills by the end of his career, he's going to be incredible. But RJ Lewis is already above that in the skill department. And he moves with just an incredible athleticism as well. But the most impressive thing about him is he already has this incredible nose for basically how to contort his body at the right angles to always get his shot open. In the mid-range, he's playing like that old guy at the YMCA who can't move anymore, but is scoring 10 points anyway, except RJ Lewis is an A to A minus level athlete doing the same thing. He finds a spot every time. He twists around defenders. Like, I'm just going to say it right now. He will be on my preseason top 10 Atlantic 10 players next year because I'd rather miss early with this guy than miss late. He's going to be a superstar on a very good team before his career is done, whether it's at UMass or a Power Five school. This is a guy who I believe is on a path to be a number two or number three option on a very good NCAA tournament level team.
I think what always throws me off with Luis too, with his quickness and ball handling, I always think of him as a guard, and I have to remind myself he's 6'7". He's big too, for how skilled he is.
And he has like no muscle yet. So that should be coming this offseason as well. But I guess we'll carry it on to the player of the year conversation. And I think for most people, it came down to largely two, maybe three guys. I ended up going with Daron Holmes at the final moment. This was the last change on my ballot. I had Ace Baldwin's name typed in. And I kept going back and forth here. Do I treat this like the MLB MVP or the NBA MVP? And there's a big difference. In baseball, it just goes to the best player. It doesn't matter that the Angels win 71 games every year and are out of playoff contention by Labor Day. They get the AL MVP every year because their players are excellent. The NBA, the team record focuses in so critically. A lot of times it's the best player on the best team, to the point that even though Joel Embiid's stats are a little bit better than Nikola Jokic's, Denver's going to get the one seed in the West, and Jokic will probably win the MVP again because of that. And Holmes and Baldwin are so close, both so excellent on the offensive and defensive ends of the floor. And I was basically ready to just go with Ace, with wins just simply being a tiebreaker here. But in the last moment, I just thought back to five, six different games where Daron Holmes was just such an incredible dominant force throughout the year. And there was just no question in half of Dayton's games that he was the best player on the court. And Ace Baldwin just, he simply didn't do that. And really, really no one did. James Bishop did it once or twice. Josh Aduro did it once or twice. Daron Holmes did it like seven times.
And I thought it was a pretty easy selection for Daron, to be honest with you, to bring some numbers, to quote Zach Lowe with your warps and schwarps and vipums. Win shares, he's by far had the largest amount of win shares in the conference at 5.9, 1.1 more than Tumani Kamara, who was next in the conference. He by far had the best box plus minus of any player in the conference. Again, 7.1 to, and Tumani Kamara was second at 6.6. You know, he's one of the highest usage players in the conference. He's one of the best rim protectors in the conference. His impact on both sides of the floor just meant to me that he was very clearly the best player in the conference. And, you know, Ace was an interesting one. I just kind of what we've been talking about with VCU, you know, this entire time, he's clearly the best player on VCU, and VCU was clearly the best team in the conference this year. It's just, Daron was just so much better. Daron was on the second best team of the conference, and he was just so much better than everyone else on his team. You know, he carried that Dayton team to wins on his back so many times. So it was the numbers and just kind of watching it. He had the biggest impact of any player on the conference, and for me, that's why he was my conference player of the year.
Yeah, I think for me, with Ace, it would have reminded me a lot, or maybe he'll win the actual award, but kind of a similar season to when Jordan Jett won A-10 Player of the Year, just scoring about 12, 13 points on an insane defensive team that St. Louis team was. But I just think Ace had a lot of help. Like you guys said, VCU had a lot of guys that could be the best player on any given night. But to me, Daron's efficiency, scoring 18 points despite Dayton easily playing the slowest tempo in the conference, like, he would still get great numbers. And imagine if they were a little bit more of a run and gun team. But I tweeted this out last week, and I feel like it holds true. I think Daron Holmes didn't get quite as much hype this year for player of the year, just because he went in with crazy expectations, maybe higher than we've seen from any A-10 player in the last 5-6 years. Like, he was a projected first round pick, and now we're seeing him in the second round instead. So wasn't like he basically wasn't Obi Toppin. He was really good though.
And I think that's just kind of how he plays. You know, we think of someone like Obi Toppin, like you mentioned, and it's the high flying dunks, and it's the it's, you know, getting out all by himself doing windmills. But I think Daron is very clearly a better defensive player than Obi. And, you know, being that defense is so critical to Dayton's play, you know, his impact is a lot more than Obi, because he's scoring efficiently. You know, I think he he's either among the leaders or is the leader in dunks. It's just they're not the top 10 dunks of SportsCenter. But they count 2 points just the same. You know, not to sound like your dad, but you know, his impact on rebounding, his impact on defense. You know, it's critical to what Dayton is. Dayton, I mean, they certainly would not be a top four team without him. And I don't know if I would say that they're a pillow fight team because they have a lot of talent, but just they certainly would not be second without Daron Holmes, and who knows where they would be.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this last week. Daron's not getting the same level of credit and hype this year because he didn't add the three-point shot. He didn't develop the Obi-level playmaking. He just became more dominant at the things he was already good at. He's an incredible post-up player. He's a great at-the-rim finisher. He's an incredible shot blocker. He went up a notch in all of those regards, but we saw him do great things with all of those last year. And so it kind of took some of the luster off of what's still been a spectacular season. So we'll carry on. I think at this point we can probably start to go a little bit more rapid fire here. Defensive player of the year, once again, sorry, Ace Baldwin, you're the runner up. I went with Tamani Kamara here. Just the ultimate Swiss Army knife. Really the only guy in the conference who can guard all five positions and not just do it competently, but do it extremely well. And I still think they would have won the George Mason game if he's guarding Ronald Polite in crunch time. But I think he was hampered by foul trouble. Was that the issue in that game? I don't remember at this point. It's been a long week, but I just felt like he made more greatly impactful defensive plays on a game-by-game basis than anyone else.
Yeah, Tyler, I also picked Tumani Kamara, and I just think, how many times this year did we text during games and say, like, oh, like this guy's killing us, we got to put Tumani on him? Yeah, the versatility put him over the top, and I feel like when it comes to Dayton, too, like, a really good defensive team, but they're mostly anchored by two players, where VCU always has four or five great defenders on the court. So yeah, to me, Kamara was just the most important player to one team's defense this year.
Yeah, and a third for Tumani Kamara for defensive player of the year. You know, my highlight impact stat to show that when he was off the court, teams took 36.4% of their shots at the rim against Dayton, and when he was on the court, they took 31.7% of their shots at the rim. When he was on the court, they made 50% or 55% of those shots. When he was on the court, they made 50% of those shots. So he's just an impact player. He meets the 2% threshold on blocks and steals. And he's really just, like you said, he can guard one through five. And he's really kind of the linchpin to what Dayton is doing defensively, along with Daron.
Guys, only four of the 18 voters voted for Kamara for Defensive Player of the Year. And the fourth one, you know who you are, and you're definitely still listening at this point. So,
oh, I'm surprised to hear that, but that's always a contentious vote. Sixth man of the year, I don't really care for this award. It's always just the best starter who happens to not start, and I think it's Javon Pickett, but I didn't spend much time.
Can I go on a quick? Can I note something very quick on here because he only got one vote. The guy who not the guy I voted for, but the guy who I think is going to win the actual award is Josh Nickleberry, who's your prototypical Jamal Crawford-esque, just come off the bench and fill it up with some hoops. He's LaSalle's second leading scorer, and that's the guy who gets rewarded in this. I think he's going to win it. Nobody put him down.
That's a fair pick, honestly. But again, it's just like he could be starting and he's not. Like,
yeah, well, that's the whole point of six man. Yeah. Like the three guys I deeply considered were him, Pickett, and the guy I chose, Kyle Rose, who, once again, he's the best defender on a top four team who is not that good on offense. They win with their defense. And so it's basically the dead opposite type of player, bringing that defensive energy to the court. But yeah, I'd take Kyle Rose. And by the way, VCU fans are going to be mad when Jameer Watkins doesn't win this. Jameer Watkins is not one of VCU's five best players. So,
I kind of don't care for this award either. I sent you Brandon Johns, and you guys had to remind me that he started. Because I looked at KenPom and saw that he wasn't in the most frequent lineup and just assumed that meant he didn't start. And of course he does. So I went with David Skogman. Is it because I thought he would do really well at the beginning of the season? Maybe a little bit, but I think on a team that struggled, you know, a team like Davidson that usually shoots the 3-point shot so well, any guy that's going to shoot, you know, 37% is someone that's going to be important in the future. He's a stretch forward. You know, he can rebound, and I think he'll see a bigger role next year in his senior season with the Wildcats. So hastily, I took David Skogman.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty good pick. He's a true six man. He's actually Davidson's sixth best player on most nights. Although minutes wise, I think he's the seventh man now because Connor Kuchera is playing more coming off the bench than him. But we'll go to most improved. This was really easy. This reward was done for me in January. And Polite made a big kick at the end of the season to get in contention. Guys, Brendan Adams got benched last year. Like, he was unplayable at the end of last season. He's going to make all conference. That's as big of a leap as you can make.
So I think it's a different GW guy. I put James Bishop, and I remember it was one of the ESPN Plus broadcasts when Dayton was playing George Washington at UD Arena last year, and the terrible color commentary guy, sorry if you're listening, I hope you're not, but the terrible color commentary guy said that James Bishop was one of the best players in the conference just because he had one of the highest scoring averages of the conferences. And we all laughed at that. We all heard that. We laughed at that. We said, what a silly, stupid thing to say for a guy that clearly doesn't pay attention to the Atlantic 10. And now we're debating whether or not James Bishop is conference player of the year, whether or not he's a first team all conference player. I just think that he's a guy that has shown the most improvement because he was a joke. He was the butt of a joke last year. And now he's a serious player for a serious team, you know, and worthy of being on the first conference or first team all conference or first team or second team all conference. So for me, it was easily Bishop.
Yeah, I think Bishop's definitely a fair point. And it kind of depends how you look at this award, if it's going from bad to good or good to great. And if you want to talk about someone going to a player of the year level, it's definitely Bishop. But to me, I go back to Ronald Polite. Just look back at his stats the last 2 years. He was flat out a bad player for the Patriots. He couldn't get in the rotation after coming in as a pretty prized recruit for Dave Paulson. And it just goes back. I know I already said this, but going into the year, we had no idea what George Mason's point guard situation would look like. It turned out Devin Dinkins just wasn't really ready as a true freshman for a big role. And Saquon Singleton wasn't a true point guard. So the Patriots relied on a guy who played about 6 or 7 minutes a game last year, wasn't all that efficient, and he delivered a great season. So to me, it's Polite just how he performed down the stretch of the season. And simply, they're a pillow fight team to me without him.
I think Polite actually got hurt by the fact that Xavier Johnson was so bad at the end of last season. Because if Polite was still coming off the bench playing like 8 minutes a game like he was midway through last year, then he's in the same boat as where Adams was, basically. But he got shoehorned into having to start for them down the stretch. And so he was starting from a little bit of a higher place. Although he was the most improved in season. Because before he got hurt at the Paradise Jam, he was pretty bad their first few games this year.
I actually think I was going to bring this up. I think the most improved in season would have to be David Shriver for VCU, who I want to talk about a little bit
later.
They
were not using him right in November. I remember getting pissed off week 2 of the season that they weren't putting him in good spots. So I blame Mike Rhodes for that one a lot.
He still went on to lead the conference with a 48% 3-point shooting percentage in league play after, I mean, he wasn't making any impact, although maybe that was not sure how to use him properly. But yeah, I mean, he honestly could have been an answer for this too, if you looked at it that way. All right. Now I think we have one more real award left, and that is Coach of the Year, which I'm interested to hear because there's been a lot of back and forth between a couple fan bases on Twitter. So I guess, Matt, do you want to start this one off for us?
Sure. And you know, all the numbers, all the stats, crunch them all. Fordham is a top 4 team this year. It's Keith Ergo. And you know, to get into the numbers and to get into to why he actually deserves it. Everyone thought, you know, Kyle Neptune's leaving. You know, unfortunately, they were a great story last year, Fordham, but they're probably going to turn back into the old Fordham this year. And you know, the metrics and the algorithms reflected that. KenPom had them ranked 229th in the country at the beginning of the season. They're going to finish 100, or they're going to finish 79 places better than that, and that's, you know, unfortunately more than what Duquesne thought. You know, what happened with Duquesne? KenPom thought had Duquesne ranked 136th to start the season, so we thought, you know, maybe there was a little bit more hope for Duquesne. You know, it's certainly not to take away what Keith Bambrot did with that team. You know, they won, you know, single digit games last year to get them within, you know, a game of being a top four seed. You know, that's very, very, you know, admirable. But I think Keith Urgo's, you know, the runaway choice for me, just because it's Fordham. And you know, we've made for years and years, they've been the butt of a joke. They've been a meme, you know, Fordham too high. And now he's got them with a double bye.
Yeah, I ended up going with Urgo as well. And if you broke this down into little bits and pieces, different coaches won different elements of this season. Keith Dambrot was the best general manager. He won the offseason, put everything together in assembling that team. Mike Rhodes was the best X's and O's coach by far this year. Fran Dunphy, I think, set up the best culture and the best program. Chris Caputo was the best at player development. But Keith Urgo was excellent at all of those things, bringing them all together, bringing in Khalid Moore, who I ended up picking as my transfer of the year. Somehow he replaced basically all of Chuba Oham's offense. He developed the two centers into great defensive replacements for Oham's, turned Darius Quisenberry into a better passer, a better defender, and a better leader, built up the camaraderie around that team. And did a little bit of marketing on the side, being accessible all season, giving the fans someone to root for. Mike Rhodes did an excellent job. And if we're just talking about what happened on the court this year, it's Mike Rhodes. But Keith Urgo was the everyman, and he turned Fordham from what very easily could have been a garbage program again into a legitimate contender. Guys, in a week, Fordham could actually be in the NCAA tournament field. It's still not likely, but it's possible. And that's something that we haven't been able to say for multiple decades.
Yeah, it's crazy. And the fact that Fordham had a glimmer of hope last year, we thought it might get ripped away with Kyle Neptune leaving, and turns out they were even better this year. Keith Urgo should get a ton of credit, and I'm excited that he's going to be a coach in the A-10. It seems like he loves Fordham and Fordham loves him back. But I'm giving A-10 Coach of the Year to the guy who won the league by 3 games. I'm sorry, I'm just not punishing VCU for being good. Like, I feel like this award has turned into who overachieved the most, but if you go back
That's what it is in
preseason,
every sport.
well, not really though. The A-10, it usually just goes to who wins the conference. So I'm interested to see what ends up happening here. But like, I picked VCU. If here's my little humble brag, yes, I did pick VCU to win the conference. No one else was doing that. VCU was clearly behind St. Louis and Dayton back in October. And I just don't think we should penalize Rhodes for living up to the expectations. Like we talked about it with Dr. John last week. When you're supposed to be good, there's a lot of pressure on you to win those games. And VCU ended up winning the conference by such a large margin. I also just think player development for Rhodes, too, and recruiting, that was such a big impact. He loses an NBA player, Vince Williams, and basically fills the spot with another great all-around grad transfer, Brandon Johns. He adds much needed shooting in David Shriver and turns him into one of the best role players in the conference down the stretch. And we thought it might be important that they lose Hassan Ward, one of the best rim protectors. It turns out Jalen Deloach was just even better for him. So I thought he got the most out of his team. And it's just hard. Like, if he won the conference by 1 game, then yeah, I would give it to Urgo. But VCU just, at the end of the day, they had clearly the most successful conference season for me.
And
And I
let's
think that's
make
a
one thing very clear here. Urgo won the narrative a month ago. he is going to win this award. Whether it should be Rhodes or not, he's going to win this award.
Yeah.
I think those are fair points about Rhodes, you know, especially with what a disappointing season it was for the conference at whole, but in particular for Dayton and St. Louis, who had top 25 expectations. And you want to talk about, you know, being good when you're expected to be good. You know, that's just what VCU does every year. And, you know, maybe Anthony Grant and Travis Ford seem to struggle with that. So I think those are fair points, but I mean, it's just, it's Fordham and they're fourth. So.
Yeah. And I think too, the one thing I will give Ergo the most credit for, and this is something that Kyle Neptune wasn't able to do. Like, even though Fordham was much better last year, was there that much excitement around the Rams? Not really. Like, Keith Ergo captivated a fan base. You had students painting their chests with his name, Ergonomics, in the front row. Fordham sold out almost every home conference game. Like, there is a buzz around Fordham basketball, and I can't wait to see it. I really hope they turn out to the Barclays Center next week, because it's a quick trip for them. They've been super passionate at Rose Hill this year, and maybe that home court advantage, like, we could see him in the tournament. You never know.
It'll just be a shame when he's coaching St. John's next year and they have to start it all over again.
I'm on record as saying in April that Fordham can't have nice things, and so Ergo was either going to suck or he was going to be so good that he was going to get an incredible job offer within the first 2 years and leave.
Well, knock on wood, he stays. I mean, it sure seems like, I don't know, every team always says, like, oh, our coach loves the school, and it seems that way for him. But now it's just exciting that Fordham was able to continue their success, and it wasn't just a one-year flash in the pan.
Lucky for Fordham fans, though, St. John's will be hiring a head coach at a smaller conference, New York College, but just one who's had national championships taken away. So I think they will actually survive any overtures from St. John's to try to get Ergo. But these final awards, we throw in some other fun ones here, ones that should exist, but I'll rattle them all off here quickly because we don't need to go too deep. Transfer of the Year, Khalid Moore just talked about that. Sharpshooter of the Year became really easy yesterday when David Shriver went 4 of 6 in like a 2 minute span to basically what we thought put away GW. They somehow came roaring back from that, but he ended up grabbing the conference 3-point percentage crown in doing so. Glue Guy of the Year, I made him ineligible when I did my old Glue Guy team last week, but then I realized he has no chance of actually making all defense. Antrell Charlton, just a do-it-all, do-all-the-dirty-work guy for Fordham. And Game of the Year, I wanted to pick something else because this game sucked for all three of us. But there just weren't that many great – honestly, like, there weren't that many great games this year with thrilling finishes. And so I just have to sigh. It's the VCU comeback against Dayton, which, if you're rooting for any of the other 14 teams, you probably had a great hour watching that second half.
Yeah, I didn't pick that game. That was my worst game of the year. But agreed on your first two. Khalid Moore for Fordham is the transfer of the year. David Shriver is the sharpshooter. For me, the glue guy, I mean, this is always a tough vote. I still don't even know.
Way too many people don't know what a glue guy is.
I don't know what a glue guy is. I have no idea. But Nick Kern shot 72%. Yeah, he shot 72% from two in conference play. And for me, what it comes down to is he got in the starting lineup in January and VCU started playing better. Like, he doesn't have a huge role. He is deathly afraid of shooting the ball from three. Like, he's basically sophomore year Keyshawn Curry. And once he develops an offensive game, I actually think Nick Kern could be really, really good for the Rams. But for this year, he's a glue guy. Just super efficient on offense. And unfortunately, he can't shoot, but when he does have the ball, good things happen.
Yeah, and when VCU moved him into the starting lineup, put Watkins on the bench, everyone was talking about, oh, this will make Watkins more comfortable. He gets to be more of a heat check scoring sixth man. They did that move because they couldn't force turnovers against Duquesne. Like, their press outright sucked that night. The Dukes were just dribbling the ball up the court comfortably, and they needed a little bit more athleticism at the point of attack. And ever since they made that move and put Kern back in, him, Nunn, and Baldwin together, and then sub any of those three out for Zeb Jackson, that's vintage VCU attacking on the perimeter.
Yeah. And then last pick for me too, game of the year, GW won four overtime games. I'm going to go with their double overtime, 107-105 over Richmond, which also included a crazy comeback. I think James Bishop scored 6 points in the final 45 seconds.
Yeah, so I'm going to start with the last one first with the game of the year. It's another GW game. It's their overtime game against St. Joe's, where they had GW had a win probability of 95% with about 5 seconds to go, and it went into overtime. And then St. Louis had a win probability of over 75% with about 2 minutes to go, and they lost. So that game was really exciting. It was an ESPN Plus game, kind of, I believe it was, you know, a Wednesday night where there were a bunch of games, and I think it was the last one that finished. So everyone, all the A10 nerds, you know, were able to watch that one, and it was just a back and forth, high scoring game where both teams seemingly had it won and then ended up giving it away, and finally GW won at home. And that's also where I learned that the ESPN Plus GW color commentator has a little bit of a raspy voice. So, you know, there's definitely a lot of character in the color commentators of the ESPN Plus broadcast, and his was a pleasant surprise learning that GW's guy sounded like he had marbles in his mouth while he was talking to us. Going through the rest of the kind of the last ones, transfer of the year, I thought for sure that Tyler was going to have Day-Day Grant as his, but he is mine.
It was until yesterday.
Okay. And then sharpshooter of the year, Kobe Brea is who I went with, just because his percentage was a little higher compared to the other guys, and his usage was a little higher than compared to the other guys. So put all the 3-point shooters on a graph, and the ones in the right quadrant, Kobe Brea had was the farthest up and farthest to the right. So he's who I went with in terms of 3-point attempts and 3-point percentage. And then the final one, I talked about his intangibles, you know, the entire podcast. So I'm going to go with Glue Guy of the Year. It's kind of a as you said, kind of one that's open to interpretation, but I'm going with Darius Quisenberry again.
All right. Those are the A10 awards dissected in about as lengthy of a podcast as we can get. Before we wrap this thing up, Matt, since you're our guest, any thoughts that you have, initial looks at this A10 tournament bracket?
Yeah, so I think that we talked about VCU, you know, being the best team all season, and how Rhodes, you know, could be possibly coach of the year and deserve it. And I think they really got a tough draw for the A10 tournament. I think having to play SLU in the semis, while Dayton could possibly play Fordham, they could possibly play, you know, basically Dayton can avoid St. Louis and VCU till the final, and that just definitely have me convinced that Dayton is not going to win the final, that Dayton is going to lose in the final. They're going to have a plum draw to get to the final. No trouble. They're going to cruise there. Dayton Twitter is going to be cocky, and they're going to lose by 4 to VCU in the final.
I think we all had the same first thought when we looked at that bracket, that, oh my God, like, it's kind of inexcusable for Dayton to not make the final. This is the conference of chaos in the season where nothing makes sense. I can promise you one of two things is happening here. Either A, Dayton's just putting everything together. They're not only making the final, but they're going to slap around VCU or St. Louis in the final. And everyone's going to feel great going into the NCAA tournament. Or they're going to lose some idiotic game before that. Like, we can talk about how good this draw looks all we want, and I still think Dayton matches up really well against GW. GW kicked their ass. Like, Dayton's going to be coming out cold in their first game against a team that really just tore them apart this year, most likely. As we've seen in their two games so far, St. Joe's could very well beat GW, but, like, no one is talking about that at all.
That's definitely the game that worries me, you know, sitting there. But GW kind of got a little, they shot pretty well. They're definitely a good offensive team. But I think, Dayton will kind of be motivated in that game, want to right or wrong. And it's just, as a Dayton fan, when good things happen, someone said this at the beginning of the year when Dayton was ranked 24th, if you're happy that Dayton is ranked 24th, you haven't been a fan long, because all you're thinking about is what can go wrong. So I think, they're going to cruise through to the finals, but then they're going to lose in heartbreaking fashion.
Now, I will say, if they get to Saturday, either Fordham or Duquesne is just a way better game for them than St. Louis or George Mason. So that did break very well for them.
I want to talk about George Mason, because right now the Patriots are coming in on a 6 game winning streak. At an unnamed sportsbook, you can get them at 25-1. And man, like, assuming they get past their Wednesday game, I think they match up well with St. Louis. That could have been a game of the year. St. Louis made a great comeback after Travis Ford got tossed in that one. But I wouldn't sleep on the Patriots. I mean, at those odds, if you're looking to gamble, this is one of the hottest teams in the conference.
Well, I was going to say, I think it was Petey Buckets who's long suffered at the hands of VCU as a George Mason fan. VCU to him is like the horror movie villain where you got to make sure that they're definitely dead before you kill them. And I can definitely see Mason getting to the semifinals and definitely losing to VCU, just because there's that, voodoo in their head that they can't, get past the big bad, neighbor to the, I don't know which direction Richmond is compared to Fairfax, but to their neighbors, that they've long suffered from, I definitely can see them struggling to get past them.
The thing is, I'm not sure it's going to be VCU though. Like, if we're talking about this as the season of chaos, we know the one seed struggles in the quarterfinals, and VCU is either going to play Davidson, who played them very close in the last matchup, and that game could have gone to overtime if Des Watson converted at the free throw line. Or they could play St. Bonaventure, who already beat VCU this year. So I know they're struggling a bit right now. But I think you had a really important point, Matt, that VCU got a pretty challenging draw in their first game.
Guys, I've wanted George Mason St. Louis for weeks. The last two games have been too close. George Mason's taking the next one. Aduro is such a problem for Okoro. And the way Ronald Polite's playing right now, and we talked about with Dr. John, St. Louis can't stop dribble penetration. Ronald Polite might just tear them apart right down the middle in that game. And I'm going to say right now, George Mason is either making the semis, or in the reverse of that, a team that they've narrowly beaten in two very good games the last two times they've played them, they might just lose to Richmond before that. Because as we know, as soon as George Mason gets hyped up, they throw out a huge clunker.
Yeah, sounds like our Dayton Flyers, doesn't it?
And my final thought for this, I said it at the beginning of conference play, a pillow fight team will make the quarterfinals. I feel great about that right now. Like I just said, Richmond's played George Mason tight twice this year. St. Joe's has played two great games with GW. And God, can we please get that again? Because neither of them are going to play any defense now, especially if Obina and Klocek are still out. That game might be like 95-93 in regulation. Just let us watch that. Or even UMass, who I guess got Matt Cross back. No one expected that to happen. They could beat George Mason as well. I'm going to ignore the other one because Duquesne killed LaSalle 2 weeks ago. And everything on paper says that they should do it again if they play them again. And I think Rhode Island just stinks to high hell. So one of those two games, I think one of the Georges is going to go down on Wednesday.
And you mentioned St. Joe's there real quick, and I really feel like it's not going to be them, possibly making it to that round, just because I think Obina is one of the most underrated players in the conference. And without him, they're in trouble. So I think that their season will come mercifully to a quick end, not against Loyola, but probably against George Washington. It might, be entertaining. There might be well, there definitely will be a lot of 3-point attempts with both those teams, but yeah, without Abena, I think they're in some real trouble.
I would have picked St. Joe's to get upset by Loyola if they hadn't just beat Richmond. I think that I think they're awful without Obina. They can't stop anybody, but I guess apparently they could stop the Spiders. So I'm a little thrown off right now. But I also just factor in GW can beat anybody, and God, they can lose to anybody on any given night. So they'd be vulnerable against a mid-tier NEC team if the shots aren't falling for them. But I guess that's it. Anyone want to fire out a final thought before we close this thing out?
I think I'm out of thoughts. That was exhausting going through the awards, but I think we had some good discussion. This is like our Super Bowl time of the year, you know, talking conference tournaments, awards. Next week is just going to be a blast. And even though it's not a three bid season, that doesn't take away from how great next week's going to be.
I will leave with this thought. If VCU, Dayton, Fordham, or Duquesne win the Atlantic 10 tournament, they're going to win their first round game. And I think that just because they do something unique in all of them, you know, Dayton, VCU, and Fordham play defense, and Duquesne's 3-point shooting, that it allows for variance to occur. And against a better team, a higher seed, you know, it presents a good opportunity for an upset to happen. So I think if one of those teams gets probably definitely gets the only bid for the Atlantic 10 this year, they're going to win a first round game. So I wanted to leave with that thought.
I'm excited with that too. I actually very much believe that.
Except for St. Louis, they're going down, right?
I didn't want to specify to you know, upset the West Pine Bills guys, but I left them out for a reason. I do not think that they could win I think they could definitely have a shot of winning the Atlantic 10 tournament. I definitely do not think that they would win an NCAA tournament game.
My final thought, we're headed towards the possibility of Duquesne and Fordham again on Thursday night in the quarterfinals. The Fordham faithful should be making their way in. As I tweeted out, a tweet that was found by both Keith Ergo and their athletic director. So they are already trying to build the hype. Everyone's going to assume that they will roll in that game because they're going to look at what happened this weekend and the fact that they really just slapped Duquesne. That RJ Gunn technical foul, just it threw off the entire game. And by the way, same thing happened the night before where RJ Blakeney flopped in the way Quisenberry did, and they gave the double tech for instigating. And I actually thought they were going to in that instance again, too. But at that moment, Duquesne just, like, their spirit died in a way that it has not in any single game this entire year, save for, like, the last 5 minutes when Kentucky was killing them. It was so weird that they couldn't recover. It's so unlike them. If they play again, it's going to be a lot more like the game that was played in Pittsburgh back in January. Just a back-and-forth, each team just punching each other in the mouth rock fight. I hope it happens. I think it will be an excellent game. And from a betting perspective, if you're going to gamble on that, if you're going to jump on Fordham, be careful with that line. Don't think too much about what happened in the second half of the regular season finale. But that does it for this episode. Matt, thank you for joining us once again to talk awards. Everyone who's still listening at this point should be following you by now, but who knows? Maybe we picked up some new listeners. Maybe there's some Loyola people who don't know who you are. So where can they find you?
Yeah, I am on Twitter. I am at A10 Stats. That's just all Atlantic 10 basketball. The occasional picture wondering why the St. Joe's Hawk is at a Fairfield game. But other than that, it's all Atlantic 10 Stats. If you want to just follow my personal account, there's a lot more Scottish soccer. Those are happy tweets these days about my favorite team, Celtic. And that's at Matt, REIN86. But if you just want the basketball Atlantic 10 coverage, go to at A10 Stats and you can find me there.
Yep. And you all know where to find us next week. We will be back with a new mini episode, probably on Wednesday. Unless something completely nuts happens in the pillow fight, we won't be recording anything that night. We got to deal with making our way out to New York. Let us know if you'll be in Brooklyn We will be there as well. And thank you all for listening. Please give us 5 stars on iTunes and be sure to check back in throughout the week. We got plenty of pods coming.